The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good morning, everyone. We're starting a little bit late, so I'd like to get going now. I imagine people will be joining us shortly. My name is Christine Haight Farley, and I'm an Associate Dean for Academic Affairs and a Professor of Law here at American University Washington College of Law. And on behalf of the law school, I'd like to welcome you all to today's exciting conference, the European Union, a Model for the U.S., Assessing 50 Years of the Treaty of Rome. Today's event is part of WCL's annual Founders Celebration, which we host each spring in honor of the two pioneering women, Ellen Spencer Mussey and Emma Gillette, who founded our law school in 1896 with the conviction that legal education was key to achieving gender equality. Through our annual Founder Celebrations, we offer approximately 60 engaging programs on a wide variety of cutting-edge and fascinating topics relating to business, human rights, intellectual property, international trade, gender, national security, health, and so on. The extensive programming reflects our commitment to offering this public service to engage our community, the nation, and the world on key issues of our time. Events such as today's conference serve as important fora to discuss fundamental as well as novel issues on important topics by bringing together individuals with extensive knowledge and varied experiences. This conference on the Treaty of Rome has brought together distinguished diplomats, academics, advocates, and practitioners from both the U.S. and the EU who will share with us their extensive experiences and unique insights on this important topic. We are delighted to have with us His Excellency John Bruton, Ambassador and Head of Mission of the European Commission Delegation to the United States, as well as His Excellency Klaus Schirot, Ambassador of the Federal Republic of Germany to the United States, both of whom will be giving remarks today. WCL is an ideal place for today's conference, as we have a long-standing and demonstrated commitment to the study of international law. We are also a community made up of individuals from around the world. For example, our International Legal Studies program, which just yesterday celebrated its 25th anniversary, brings together approximately 180 foreign lawyers each year from approximately 68 countries who speak 90 plus languages. Students from many European countries are enrolled in the ILSP, which enriches our educational environment tremendously. We also have many student organizations that are very active in many international issues, including our International Trade Law Society, who is one of the co-sponsors of today's event. I would also like to thank the ILSP LLM Executive Board Conference Committee, a student organization that organized today's event, as well as the International Trade Law Society and the American Society of International Law, which are co-sponsoring this event. This discussion of the Treaty of Rome is very timely. Negotiations with Turkey and Croatia are underway, and membership has grown to 27 countries, including many former communist nations. The EU has agreed on a 7-year budget and developed ambitious plans for energy policy and for tackling global warming. During its 50 years, the Treaty of Rome laid the foundation for European economic integration and largely achieved what it set out to do, namely avoid another war and enable member economies to expand and further integrate. At the same time, while much progress has been made, challenges remain, including universal acceptance of the draft constitution, stagnant labor markets, and high unemployment. Recent protests in France also demonstrate the difficulty of reform when it affects entrenched interests. Fortunately for us, we have here this morning His Excellency John Bruton, Ambassador and Head of Mission, European Commission Delegation to the United States. We are honored that he was able to join us, and I am certain that his extensive experience and expertise will greatly benefit our discussion. Ambassador Bruton was President of the EU in 1996, in which capacity he oversaw the finalization of the Stability and Growth Pact, which governs the implementation of the euro. He served as Irish Prime Minister from 1994 to 1997, and before that as Ireland's Minister for Finance, Minister for Industry and Energy, Minister for Trade, Commerce and Tourism, as well as Parliamentary Secretary. He was first elected to the Irish Parliament in 1969 at the age of 22, and later rose to become party leader. Since his term as Prime Minister, Ambassador Bruton served as a leading member of the convention that drafted the EU Constitution. At the convention, he was a strong supporter of proposals to restore democratic legitimacy to EU institutions. He was also Vice President of the European People's Party from 1999 to 2005. Without further delay, please join me in welcoming Ambassador Bruton.
I'm very glad to have this chance to talk to you about the European Union in the week that it commemorates 50 years of its existence. The European Union came into being at the very outset as a political project. Anyone who reads the Messina Declaration of 1955, which led to the convening of the conference that drafted the Treaty of Rome, will see from the beginning that it was the objective of those founding that union to form a political union. It was never their idea that it would be simply some sort of a trade pact or some sort of an alliance of countries. It was a political union, an ever closer union of the peoples of Europe that it was their object to create. And anybody who joined, any country that joined the European Union, joined it on the basis of treaties which made it clear in the very first line that the purpose was to create an ever closer union. And I think it is important to reflect upon why it is necessary to, and has been necessary to, the European Union's success, that it has that overarching political objective of an ever closer union. The principal reason is that the success of the European Union has been the result of individual countries putting the interests of the union as a whole ahead of their own interest, of not looking at issues of the European Union in terms of a jus retour, of getting more back than they put in financially to the European Union. Germany, for example, for many, many years, the Netherlands for many years also, has been putting in far more money and contributions to the European Union than anything that it gets back. And it did that because it supported the overall political objective of an ever closer union within Europe. And I think it's important that that is understood and acknowledged. One might ask, well, wouldn't it have been quite sufficient not to have those transfers of funds? Would the European Union have worked just as well without the regional fund, with simply common rules about agricultural subsidy but no financial support for farmers from the centre, without a social fund, without any collective investment in research for the benefit of the whole? Would the European Union have worked just as well as a simple rulemaking body? I don't think it would, because I think at the end of the day, all law rests on consent. If everybody decided that they were going to break a particular law on any particular day, that law would become null and void that day, because it would be not possible to enforce it. All law rests on the consent of those who are abiding by it. That consent is assisted by various penalties and the risk of detection and so forth. But if a particular law was simply rejected by everybody, it would no longer exist, regardless of how it had been passed and ratified and so on. So I think to achieve a law accepting European Union, you need to have that overall political objective. Contrast the compliance with European Union law with compliance with international law. Effectively, people can abide by international law when it suits them. We see the example here of this country not abiding by international law and the way it is, which it is keeping people in custody in place of legally ambiguous status in the island of Cuba at the moment. That's a clear breach of international law by any measure or standard, and no pretense is really maintained that it is legal, really. And that just demonstrates, it's just one other example. To take another example of the way in which in China, in effect, intellectual property commitments that China has given are routinely ignored. And that ignoring is accepted by the national authorities. International law is something which, while very important, and will be implemented when it is in the interest of the parties to implement it, is something that can more readily be pushed aside. On the other hand, in the case of European law, because the Union is a political project, there is a greater willingness to accept EU Court of Justice decisions. Now, I've made the argument in presentations that I've made here in Washington in recent times that the European Union is both at the same time a vauntingly ambitious project and an inherently fragile one. It is vauntingly ambitious and vauntingly successful indeed when one reflects upon the fact that it has expanded from 6 members to 9 to 10 to 15 to 25 to 27 members. And at every stage, the existing members agreed unanimously to the extension. I've used this example in other contexts, but what we have done, for example, in the last 4 or 5 years in taking in 12 new member states is what it would have been in equivalent population terms would have been the case if all 50 states of the United States had individually agreed and unanimously accepted that they would extend membership to all 32 states of the United States of Mexico and had agreed in so doing that they were going to transfer substantial funds from the more prosperous states of the North to the poorer states of Spanish-speaking North America. And that those from Spanish-speaking North America were going to be free to work, maybe not immediately, but within perhaps 5 to 8 years, anywhere they wanted in the new enlarged United States of North America. And that now, instead of having simply 100 senators, or 2 each from states of the United States as presently is constituted, you had 164 senators. And many of the key posts in the Senate, the key posts in the administration, had to be vacated by those who currently hold them, and all the political influence that goes with that diminished to make room for the new members. And all of that was agreed by each of the 50 states of the United States, not by a majority, but by all of them, that all of them agreed to this enlargement. That's what the European Union has done. Not proposing to do, has actually done since 2004. Do you think that would have been something that we would have done if the European Union was simply a trade pact? No. It had to have this global political ambition of an ever closer union. It had to offer some idea towards which people would aspire. It had to lift people out of themselves and out of their own individual national prisons of viewing the world. But it is also corrosive. It is also a very fragile project. Because we have seen in recent times a number of countries, a number of prime ministers, one of whom famously went to Brussels and said, "I want my money back." Well, because she felt that because a lot of goods were coming in through her country to Europe on their way to other parts of Europe, they were coming through ports of her country, that the money that was collected at those ports was, quotes, her money. And therefore, if she wasn't getting enough back from EU funds, the amount should be reduced. And of course, once one got away with that, other states as well felt that they should get their money back. And we've seen that particular viewpoint being expressed not infrequently in the Netherlands, for example. And probably it's the frustration that they weren't, as they felt it, getting their money back that may have lain behind the rejection of the latest constitutional treaty that was put before the European people. Now, that attitude, of course, I think, ultimately, if it were to be continued and to become accepted, would destroy the European Union. Another thing that could, I think, destroy the European Union quite quickly would be if, for any reason, possibly because of nationalist sentiment or the sort of the sentiment I've just described, a country were to decide, well, look, the law of the European Union may be such, and the European Court may have interpreted it in such a way as to impose a fine on us for doing something we haven't done, but we're not going to pay. Or they said, the European Court of Justice said, well, you must open up your market to X or Y, products from other countries, and they said, well, sorry, we're not going to do it. That would be the end of the European Union. Now, you can have countries who will say, well, we'll agree to international conventions on things, but then we won't implement them. That doesn't lead to the collapse of the world because people don't have the same expectations of international law, for the reasons I've explained. They do have different expectations within Europe of what it means. And I think the European Union is a unique engine for the creation of a condition of legal order that is appropriate to a globalized world, backed by the cement that is created by a sense of common emotional destiny. I know that there is talk about Europe's economic problems at the moment, although last year the European economy has grown faster than the United States. And if you take the 50 years that we're discussing here since the Treaty of Rome, income per head in the United States has increased 15-fold. People are 15 times better off now than they were in 1957 in the United States. They are 19 times better off in the European Union. So taking the long period, that's the record. The social model, the European social model was pretty well there in 1950, from the 60s on. And it's only since the 1990s that the United States has actually grown faster than the European Union countries have done. So I don't think Europe's social model explains our economic problems entirely, if you would describe them as economic problems. In many ways, I think public discourse in its nature focuses on problems. Good news isn't news. The fact that Europeans in opinion polls express the highest level of satisfaction with life in the world, on average, I mean, there's some countries who have less than others, but I think of the top 6 or 8 countries in terms of life satisfaction, I think more than 2/3 of them are EU members. That's not to be discounted. I think that's important. It's more important than GDP, which GDP doesn't measure most important things in life at all. It only measures things to be counted in money. And it's a very poor measure of performance in any reasonable social discussion. But I think what has been found is that you can actually closely track life satisfaction with the objective measure at the level of hypertension that people suffering, level of heart attacks caused by hypertension, it seemed in the Financial Times. So, and in fact, there's a very close concordance between the two, which shows that these life satisfaction polls do have a reality, a physical reality. And I think that the fact that the European Union member states do profess a higher level of satisfaction with life, therefore, is something that we, as 50-year-olds, can be proud of. I think that's enough talk, really. I'll stop now. So I take questions.
The ambassador has kindly agreed to take a few questions. If you'd like to go ahead, if anybody has questions.
Or arguments, either.
Or arguments.
Washington College of Law. I was wondering, maybe I'm mistaken, I thought Margaret Thatcher's rebate was more focused on the common agricultural policy. And I was wondering what your outlook is for the common agricultural policy. I know you've decoupled many of the the subsidies recently. I was wondering what your forecast is, what you think is going to happen, maybe to become in line with any negotiations in the Doha round as well.
Well, the common agricultural policy was the excuse that was used, but the reality is the common agricultural policy was in place when the Conservative government, of which he was a member, led Britain into the European Union. And it was in place when the British people, in a referendum in 1975, reaffirmed that decision under a Labour government. If Britain didn't want the common agricultural policy, it didn't have to join the European Union. Nobody obliged it to join the European Union. Nobody obliges any country to stay in the European Union. The common agricultural policy is a policy that deserved reform and has been reformed. It's not completely reformed, but I don't think it provides a cover for saying, adopting a sort of a, I want my money back approach to the EU budget. Because everybody, every country will find some aspect of EU policy that they don't like. And of course, by having the common agricultural policy at EU level, we prevent individual countries from having their own agricultural policies, which would distort markets internally. And in fact, I think you could argue that probably less is being spent on agriculture in Europe in those countries that are under the common agricultural policy than in other countries that are not in the European Union. If you look at Norway or Switzerland, they spend per capita more on their farmers than is spent in France under the common agricultural policy. Now, if there was no common agricultural policy and everyone had their own agricultural policy, you could well find that British goods would be shut out of continental European markets altogether as far as agriculture was concerned, because each country had its own separate agricultural policy. So, I think the issue of what's the best agricultural policy should be looked at separately. It doesn't justify an I want my money back approach.
I work with the Bosnia Support Committee. I wanted to ask about the languages in the EU. I heard that it was very, very expensive for the EU because they have to prepare all papers and so forth in many different languages, and I was wondering if that still remains a policy. Also, I just wanted to congratulate you for taking Romania, such a large country that needs so much help. And I was wondering if you could explain how, it just seems to me, how does the EU, how can they afford, I mean, is it because they don't have a war like we have to pay for, to take in poor countries and what they did for Ireland, how they helped Ireland and so forth. I guess when you're saying if the United States took in Latin America, so many people would say, well, we just can't afford it. How do you do it? How can you take on so much at one time?
Well, I suppose we're learning by doing here. The reality is that the new members that are coming in now, the 12 that have come in this decade, have not and won't be as generously treated in terms of transfers of assistance as Ireland was, for example, or as Greece was, or as Portugal was. They're not going to get as much money for all sorts of not terribly worthy internal political reasons, one of which is that our entire budget for the entire European Union is limited to 1 cent in every euro that's raised in Europe, whereas the federal budget of the United States is about 20 cents in every dollar. Our means are quite limited. And that's even more limited by the fact when individual countries want some of that money back, to come back to my earlier point. They even want part of their cent back. I think the European Union has done it because we have this broader political vision, for which I would give a great deal of credit to certain political thinkers like Maurice Schumann, Jean Monnet, Konrad Adenauer, Alcide de Gasperi, and I think Edward Heath. I think Edward Heath is one of the least praised builders of the European Union in terms of what he deserves. He's the one that persuaded Pompidou to bring Britain in. Unfortunately, he didn't remain Prime Minister long enough to make Britain truly comfortable in the European Union. It's a pity that his legacy hasn't got the honour in his own country, or in Europe as a whole, or in the world, that it deserves. On your first question, the language issue is very expensive. And one country, your name is Mullen, is it? Yeah, well, your ancestral language and mine has now been imposed as one of the languages, official languages of the European Union, notwithstanding the fact that nobody in Ireland speaks only Gaelic. Everybody in Ireland probably can read English at least as well, if not better, than they can read Gaelic. But in order to make a point, Ireland insisted on this. That's more of the sort of destructive policy making, which was on a entirely bipartisan basis. The parties were competing with one another to prove who was going to be better at insisting that this additional expense. And as you know, this increases in geometric terms, because every time you add a new language, you have to translate it into all the existing 24. So it's 24 times you add to the problem every time you add one language. But it's expensive, but it's bearable. I mean, if it's the price for keeping the European Union together, it's a price maybe we shouldn't have been asked to pay, but it's a price, if we are asked, we have to pay, because the goal is a larger one. The reality of it is, I suppose, in practice, that English is the language that's most spoken. Not at the official meetings, but at the lunches and in the corridors. It's the common language that's spoken. It's strange that the European Union is probably the greatest promoter of English in Europe, even though the country from which the language originated is not the most enthusiastic about the whole thing. But there you go. These are the ironies of the world.
Jim Kenworthy is an adjunct professor here, where I teach a course, oddly enough, called Regional and Bilateral Trade Agreements. I really have two questions. First has to do with the Constitution. It's been rejected, not acted upon, but affirmatively rejected in two countries, as I understand it. And one of the things that we saw with the Constitution is that the EU operated pretty well for, 48 years prior to the time of having to deal with the Constitution, 47 years, because they had the different treaties, they had the different acts and all this. And as I understand, the Constitution was intended to pull these together in almost a single document that could govern the country. So my first question is, what's the future of the Constitution, if any? And if they can't arrive at a constitution for all 27 members now, what will be the impact in terms of the membership of the EU? That's the first question. The second question is, 50 years, 27 countries, starting with six. What is the end game? I know a number of countries that are seeking accession to the EU. I've been in a couple, Armenia, and understand once that there are still some countries in the Balkans that want it. What is the outer limit for viability, realistically, for the membership in the EU of countries if the EU is to keep its Euro character?
I think they're very good questions, but I suppose the most accurate answer I could give to both of them is, I don't know. I don't think anybody actually knows the answer to those two questions. The European Union is a work in progress, and we're searching for answers to those two questions all the time. But notwithstanding the fact that I don't know, of course I will try and answer the question. Anyway, I think as far as the Constitution is concerned, it's over-dramatized as to its real significance. It is, as you said, mainly drawing together existing treaties. And those existing treaties all had a constitutional character anyway, because under the rules and law of the European Union, the contents of those treaties in their area of application overrule national constitutions and they overrule national law. And that was the case with the Treaty of Nice, it was the case with the Treaty of Maastricht, it was the case with the Single European Act. And what the Constitution, so-called, really wasn't new at all as a constitution in that sense, as a, you know, a founding document that overrides other documents. We've always had a constitution in those terms. What I suppose is new is, as you say, putting it together in one document, and thereby giving people a sort of an opportunity to, without any particularly clear negative consequences, to lash out at the whole entire project in a way that is more a cry for to be listened to rather than necessarily a rejection of the detailed content of the document that was actually before them. Now, I know that there are arguments. Some would say that some object to some aspects of the Constitution, but generally speaking, the debate was not about those issues in neither France or the Netherlands, I think. But under our rules, every member state must agree to the Constitution. And as we go from 6 to 27 members and further, you know, it's going to get more and more difficult to get every member to agree to a constitutional or treaty change. And that's a, you know, that's a reality that we've got to be honest about. I don't think it's likely that, certainly in the present climate of opinion, you could get an agreement to change the amending process to something like your own, where, say, two-thirds is necessary or something like that. I just feel that, that question to change the rules would have to be agreed by everybody before it could come into effect. And I feel that, at the moment, the level of trust by individual member states, populations of other member states, populations, and the sense of commonality between them isn't strong enough to allow a change in the amending procedure. And where I feel we may be at risk of putting the cart before the horse would be in attempting to invest a huge amount of political capital in getting a constitution adopted, rather than in making the sort of argument about that I was trying to make in my speech about the importance of the European Union in the world and what it does for citizens in their daily lives, how it enhances citizens' ability through their representatives to influence the way the world and globalization proceeds, and to enhance its internal democratic functioning so that people can feel, to a greater degree than they do now, that just as you can change the mayor of Washington, D.C. at the next time if you don't like him, or you can change the president of the United States the next opportunity, you could change the president of Europe or some such figure in the European Union. That sense is absent. I think those are the sorts of questions we should be addressing. How to bring the people with us, how to make the people more enthused, how to help the people to better understand what it's all about. That's more important than, shoving the Constitution over the line as some, as if that was sort of the be-all and the end-all of life. I mean, it's not. Life will go on. Life has gone on since the Constitution was rejected. The European Union has probably been busier and more effective in some respects since then than before it, if you look at what's been achieved in the last number of years. Now, of course, it doesn't have the same glorious ring to it when you have a services directive, which is something we should have had in 1958. We eventually got it through after the Constitution had been rejected. We've got the makings of a common energy policy now coming forward. We have had more enlargement of the European Union. We have the European Union probably more effective on the world stage than it has ever been. All that without the Constitution. Now, that's not to say the Constitution isn't a good thing. I was involved in drafting it. Of course, it's an absolutely brilliant production, but it's something that we can, it's more, shall we say, I put it this way, it's more important than urgent. It's important that we get something done to consolidate our treaties at some stage, reasonably soon, and that it's simple and that people can understand it and feel ownership of it. But it's not urgent. And if we try to mix up urgency with importance, we may actually get things wrong. And that's one of the things I'm preoccupied with a bit at the moment. Your second question is about the boundaries of Europe. Well, Europe is Europe. I mean, any country in Europe is eligible to join. Any country that's not in Europe isn't eligible to join. I think it's simple. Canada, much as it might fit in to the European Union, isn't in Europe. We could change our constitution to say, well, any country, you know, north of the equator or something like that could join, but I don't think that's likely. Russia, the Russian Federation, probably isn't going to join because it's a European Union all of its own, with a whole lot of nationalities, and it's a federation anyway. Countries that are in Asia or Africa, however close they may affiliate themselves with Europe, I don't think they're going to want to become members of the European Union. Turkey is both in Europe and in Asia. More of its population is in Asia, but it's in Europe, in Eastern Thrace, and therefore is eligible to join. I don't think one should set a limit beyond those very permissive limits of Europe. I don't know what basis you could start drawing other lines. I know there are some great thinkers who are arguing that we should have this existential debate about the limits of Europe. I think that's, you know, a debate that will generate far more heat than illumination.
Following up on what you just said about the boundaries of Europe, I was wondering about North Africa being so close to Europe for historical links, particularly Italy, Spain, France had colonies there, and there is considerable immigration, legal and illegal, taking place. So could you address a little bit the topic of immigration to Europe, particularly through the Canary Islands and other ports of entry, particularly through Spain, Morocco? And what the policy is? Is there a unified policy? Is there a unified security provisions to quote unquote protect the borders of the European Union? And then also the issue of the historic links with North Africa that seems to make it almost inevitable that it has to be taken into account, being so close and having, in a way, such an impact, if you want, through immigration. Provision of oil and gas through Libya, for example, to the European Union?
Well, I think if one was to make a case on closeness and interdependence, it would make equal sense to open up eligibility for membership of the European Union to the United States of America and to Canada, because the links are even greater across the Atlantic than they are across the Mediterranean in financial terms. I think in practical terms, I mean, what the European Union is a relationship, and relationships need constant investment, constant replacement, constant investment of time, constant investment of emotion, constant investment of, you know, everything that goes to building a relationship. And I think that, you know, we're stretched already. We can, time, if the existing members all settle down and get to know how to work with one another and their various interest groups, their legal professions and their farming organizations and all that become integrated into the European interest group structure, and they become fully sort of comfortable in the European Union, then we can do more in expansions to bring in more people, to give them more time for them to become more comfortable. But it's not something, in my view, that can be just rushed. It's not simply this is not an engineering problem. It's a relationship building problem that we've got to solve. I think that's what's very important to recognize. And you can say that, you know, common perceptions of history don't matter, that we all live in a sort of purely rationalist world where we all accept everybody as the same. That's in one sense, what the European Union is supposed to be about. The Enlightenment is supposed to tell us all of that. But in practice, I think we all know that we are guided by other sort of emotions and identities and affinities as well. So you can't, again, rush that, the building of it. You've got to build a common history on the basis of which you have a common affinity. And I think that's what we've been doing in the European Union. But it's a slow process. And it requires a fantastic investment. This country as well, you know, it expanded during the 19th century, but it wasn't an untroubled process, as anybody who studied 19th century American history knows. We've been able to do it without any conflicts or civil wars so far. And I think, I don't think we're going to have one either, mainly because we haven't equipped ourselves to have one. And I think that that's a very important important thing. Immigration is, there is a Euro Frontier Service, which is sort of basically working through national frontier agencies with giving them equipment and help them support to basically keep out illegal immigrants. But there isn't a common immigration policy yet, in the sense that each country has their own policy on immigration. That's not something that's decided wholly at the centre. Europe has a lot of immigrants. It has more immigrants now, I think, than it probably had in the past. And there's a lot of immigration within Europe. A very large number of people of Polish, Latvian, Lithuanianist ancestry are from those countries living and working in Britain and in Ireland. And I'm sure increasingly in other European countries, and adding a great deal to the economies of Britain and Ireland as part of our EU obligations. I think there will be more of it as long as income gaps between the poor and the rich in the world continue to go wider. We're going to have more pressure for immigration. Unless we can do something to stop this widening of income spreads, we're going to have problems. And I think it's very interesting and very significant that that's an issue that's now being addressed by the Chairman of the Federal Reserve, Mr. Bernanke. I think if you look at the speech that he made in, I think it was Nebraska in February, where he dealt with income inequalities in the United States and how unsustainable that is becoming. Well, if it's unsustainable in the United States, it's even more unsustainable in the world as a whole, the current divergence of income between top earners and the rest of society. And we've got to address that. It's not a question mainly of money, it's a question of dignity. A radical inequality of dignity is radically unsustainable.
Don Baker, I'm a lawyer here in town. You haven't talked at all about the parliament, and I wondered what your projections are on the change or continuity of relationship between the Parliament, the Commission, and the Council of Ministers.
Well, I haven't talked about the Parliament, I haven't talked about the Council of Ministers either to any great extent, nor about the Commission in any detail. I have referred to the Court of Justice a few times, okay. No significance should be attached to that. The Parliament is the only multinational parliament in the world that's directly elected by the people. That's what makes one of the things that makes the European Union different, that we have a directly elected parliament. There's no directly elected parliament of NAFTA. There's no directly elected parliament of the Andean Pact. There's no directly elected parliament of Mercosur. There's no directly elected Parliament of the United Nations or the WTO. We have one. And that's a very important part of what makes the European Union the European Union and makes it different. It makes us the only multinational democracy in the world, in a sense. For most of the work that we do, the Parliament is a co-equal legislator with the Council. For some of the work it isn't, but for most of the main rulemaking we do, it's co-equal legislation. Thanks very much.